Yeah, he had a bad accident.
It involved the dead. So
were they bad?
But were they knew exactly where I was going with that one.
Were they grateful?
They were very grateful. They were very grateful.
No, they were. They were out of touch.
Out of touch, out of mind.
Exactly.
You're out of touch.
You know, they didn't know what condition their condition was in.
You know, I've been watching a lot of Daryl's House lately.
Oh, I love Daryl's House.
Isn't that great?
And it kind of goes on what you and I were talking about earlier.
Are we rolling?
Yeah, we've been rolling.
Okay, good. So, because Daryl's House is absolutely one of those discovery moments. I remember the first time I came across Daryl's House, and he was, and I didn't necessarily like the guy, but he was on stage with, he was doing CeeLo. If you remember CeeLo Green,
yep,
mm-hmm. You know, and he's doing that, you know, and they do I Can't Go For That. And CeeLo just got so into it. It's like, okay, he has respect for that. And I just, you know, I said, and then I watched one more, and I forget who it was with.
Todd Rundgren.
Oh, my God.
He's awesome.
If you've not seen the one Todd.
They're sitting in like on a porch almost. They're in Daryl's house, but they have the whole back of the house mm-hmm. open, yep. And there's this great view, and he's just.
And it's just, and the Rund is into it. And it's like, oh, my God. That is just the epitome of just having a good old time.
Well, what I like is they intersperse their sets with they're having a little backyard barbecue and they're right. Wandering around all like, and it just makes it feel like Daryl just invited everybody over to his house and we're going to have a little meal and then we're going to like jam like we're like crazy and then we're just going to, you know, do this. Oh, yeah, you know.
But that kind of plays into what. So I was down here talking a little bit earlier. I was listening to some Carlos Santana.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, well, what should we talk about? And I was like, you know, there's musicians that really go out of their way or seem to go out of their way to help others. Like listening to Carlos, you had Rob Thomas, you had Michelle Branch, you had, you know, there's a couple of, yeah, there's like a whole big group.
Okay, but I will take objection to your statement.
Objection to my objection?
Yeah, because your statement that Carlos went out of his way, I would suggest to you.
Maybe not out of his way.
I would suggest to you that was Clive Davis's attempt, successful, I might add, to re-energize Carlos's career. And as Clive talks about in the documentary that he did, mm-hmm. where he talked about how he impacted not just young musicians starting out like a Whitney Houston and others, but how he revitalized musicians who thought they had reached the end of that level of run. And he would have visions to say, you know, you should play with this guy or record with this guy because I hear something in him that would match to what you really are able to do.
Well, wasn't one of his albums he did a while ago was all compilations from different artists?
Yeah, and who did that come from?
Was that from Clive?
That came from Clive, again. So that's the genius of Clive. Not that Carlos isn't genius. Not that Carlos isn't good. None of those things is what I'm saying. But that you sort of want to give credit to. This is where a producer, an executive producer, really comes to play, which is I hear something that you have that you don't see in yourself.
But the same thing goes, I mean, so you go back 20-odd years when Frank Sinatra did his duet album.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
Ray Charles.
He picked, I want to do duets with these 10 people. But it's a tried and true winner.
Formula. It's a formula. It's a formula. Tony Bennett.
Tony Bennett did it.
Lots of people. Barbara Streisand did it. You know, Barbara Streisand and Barry Gibbs. Okay. Come on. Not that it's the greatest duet, but what she saw in Barry Gibbs was he's a great songwriter.
He is, and a great singer.
And he's a great singer, right. And he would accompany her voice perfectly to do that. So this is where the person outside the person who has that vision can really make a difference versus, you know, I'd really like to help Rob Thomas. And I don't think
but he was doing fine with Matchbox 20 at the time.
Yeah, right. And again, it's, I don't think that Carlos didn't do it because, you know, did it only because Clive Davis right. told him, but I don't think it was Carlos's idea. Well, you know, so right. so I don't know if you remember this when Miles Davis played with Jimi Hendrix.
I don't think I was born yet. No,
okay, so Miles played with Jimi Hendrix, and I actually got to see him on stage at Fillmore. Well, who was the influencer? Anybody?
Hold on. No.
John Hammond from Columbia Pictures, Columbia Records,
right?
Actually, you know, said to Miles. Miles said, "I want to get into this." This audience who is the next generation. Yeah,
yeah. Not the jazz. It wants to move from jazz to rock. This right, sort of blues,
I want to find that path.
Right.
And he said, you need to listen to this cat.
So, again, and like Hammond, you bring in Al Kooper. And Al Kooper did the same thing many bands.
And it's interesting that these are... So you think about it, Al, Columbia Records.
Yep. Yeah.
John Hammond, Columbia Records.
Right.
Clive Davis in the beginning, Columbia Records. Unfortunately, Columbia Records is now whatever it is, Arista, whatever. But still, and where they're recording, 52nd Street Studio in New York City, which had, oh my God, some of the most incredible acoustics going. And you could, you know, everybody recorded there just because of the acoustics.
And they had the Columbia Record Club, so, you know, that's
well,
cool.
hey, 13 records.
For a penny.
For a penny.
For a penny.
And you could join as often as you wanted to. Because
as long as they didn't catch you.
there was no internet, so how are they going to catch you?
Walden came on respelling his name differently.
Yeah, really.
I just joined it 5 times. Same name, same address. Just
They didn't catch you.
Well, they didn't care.
They're coming now, Walter, now that this is on the record. Coming back later to catch
the... If only they still existed. There you go.
But they probably looked out at their bottom line and looked at it and said, we moved X amount of albums next to last
Oh, week. Yeah, they moved tons of vinyl. Because here's the thing. It was the, you know, the era of you didn't have to do, what do they call it, negative opt-in or whatever.
Yeah.
Where once you signed it, you were opt-in and obligated to buy the 10 albums.
And if you didn't...
For the rest of the year.
They didn't care.
The FBI was coming. They said you dunning notices. You owe us $10.
Whatever.
It was the mattress police, actually.
Yeah.
The mattress with the sticker, with the sticker on the mattress.
Yeah. But, you know, the DJs had record pools, the same thing. They belonged to a pool, and they would send out as many records as they had, and depending on where you're at in the pool, depending on how many, you know, quality records you got.
I thought they just drove around it with great albums in their trunk.
So you know the basic story behind that was that, you know, and this goes back to how corrupt the record industry was in the 50s and 60s. A lot of those guys were, you know, union buster organizers or mob guys or whatever. They were basically strongmen. And so they'd go in the first time into the radio station, and they'd say, "Hey Joey, here's my album. Play that new hit by that band, that cool band, Bill Haley."
Not an album, a single.
A 45.
And I don't even think they called it a 45 at the time.
No, they didn't call them 45. Just play,
play
a single.
Play that single for me, and the guy would say, "I'm not playing that." And then the next thing would be the pile of cash on top of the scene. He said, "Oh, yeah, I guess I could play that. Would you play it 10 straight times?" And the guy would go like this, spreading his fingers, you know, 10 inches high. And all of a sudden, the cashier guy, the guy played, "You know, that song was so good, we're going to play it again because you deserve to listen to this song that's going to be the next number one You know, and that's how a lot of those songs in the beginning.
Yeah.
Well, we had a few guys
got the record play.
A few guys in our club in Florida would come in and, you know, I was playing or one of the other guys were playing. They'd walk up and say, hey, can you play this? We'd put it on the table and listen to it. And I was like, yeah, we'll let it go. And it was they would hit four or five clubs in that night in that area and give out a few albums, do a little promo down on the floor, and then out the door
you
they'd
know,
go.
You ever know, you know, I'm sure that it's still going on the bars where they used to do, we're going to have Kettlewood Vodka Night, where they give you a free shot. And it's the same concept of, you know, we're going to give you a taste of that to see if you like it, and then hopefully you'll buy the record or whatever. But then the second thing was, is they'd give the guy, as Walden said, I think, 100 records.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy would say, hey, today we're giving away 100 of this Bill Haley song. So call him right now and tell us how you think. And of course,
I'll take caller five.
And the caller five says, oh, I love that song. Can I get it? Oh, yes, you can get it, Jenny. Please. And can I get your phone number also, please?
They're going to be at the Nectarine Ballroom tonight. And
when they gave away albums on, you know, radio stations, radio shows, you're like, call in. Every album they give away, it's got a whole punched out it, and it says property of, you know,
KMG.
Right, because you weren't allowed to resell
right.
it.
Yeah, and so it's a promo. But you could give them away.
Right.
And that's how they, you know, it's like, here. Yeah. You know.
I have a few records in my collection at home that have, there's just a blank label on it, and, you know, somebody wrote on it that it's so-and-so. And, I mean, they were fresh pressing.
So those were the days where they press something, and it was basically like how they do with movies, where they test market it. Will this actually get a reaction? Because if it works, let's go press 1,000 or 100,000 of these things.
Yeah, and most of these guys were coming up out of Miami. Obviously, you know, they're coming straight up the coast. Lauderdale.
Are you really saying that Miami was influenced by the mob?
No.
No, I'm saying the records were pressed in Miami, and the artists that were coming through there were coming up from Miami.
I see. His Walden winks at me. So
it was the 80s, you know.
it was the 70s and the
60s. Oh, my God. Well, I wasn't there in South Florida in the 70s.
I understand, but that's, you know, Mo Green and those guys.
So the other thing that actually, I'm just sort of tangential, go back to Columbia Record Club, but really, albums didn't take off until 65. I mean, there's a whole view of the album era and the and I think it was 65 or 66 was the first year albums outsold singles.
So what was the push for that? Was this artist coming up with so much?
Well,
you think
about it. So there were kids my age, you know, that were
72. Oh, 75.
They're in the 7 somewhere.
You know, in the early 60s, in their teens, where their parents were doing okay, it had some disposable income.
Right.
So they'd give them their allowance, and the kid would go, I want to go buy something. And the cool thing to own at the time was music.
Right.
So they all had a record player. Some of them would buy the single for 79 cents as a special, 99 cents. But for $3.99, when it first came out,
or $1.99,
you could get the whole album. So do you buy the single, or do you? And so, of course, if you got like the Meet the Beatles, where every song on it is a hit on the top 10, well, I'm just going to, you know. So, stupid me, I bought every single and I bought the album.
Then you turned around and bought the album, yeah.
Right.
But so, Columbia Record Club had a great idea. It was like, we're going to, like, make albums everywhere by just basically giving them away.
RCA had the same
idea. RCA had it, and BMG. There's a number of record
companies.
I
remember
record
they had the clubs. Checklist in the
newspaper. In the TV Guide. In the TV Guide, they had the insert. And I remember I'd drive my mom and dad nuts. Because I pull out the insert every week and, of course, pull out the staples and have the TV guy.
What happened to Monday and Tuesday?
Separated. But I had the insert with, you know, and I'm checkboxing.
So I see Lenny's angle there. They listen to music on Monday and Tuesday because they couldn't find the pages for the TV guy for Monday and Tuesday.
So the other thing they did on early albums, which you saw through the 60s and almost never in the 70s, was on the inner sleeve, they would promote 8 like promotional albums, and you could like, you know, send money to whatever recording company, and they'd send you this demo album of 10 bands or 20 bands or whatever it is, you know. And I mean, there was a whole lot of promotion to promote acts.
Well, promo guys were very big in that era.
But
promo, you know, what was the official name of those guys? They weren't promo
pushers.
Guys. No, they were
dealers.
Vinyl men.
Yeah, I don't remember. But there was a name. He's the pusher man.
He's the pusher man.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I think Steppenwolf wrote a song about that.
Yeah, it was Curtis Mayfield.
No.
That's a different Pusher Man.
Yeah. I know. The Pusher Man and the Pusher.
Curtis took that and made
a
booyah.
The Pusher Man is Curtis Mayfield.
I know. The Pusher. It's not nearly as good a song as The Pusher by Steppenwolf.
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
You could equate the two between Pusher Man, which is Curtis Mayfield with the beautiful, you know, conga playing on it, to the Steppenwolf.
Acid trip.
It's different. You know, they're both great songs.
I know.
But how could you
say one's better than the other?
Yeah.
Well, you're just telling me it's the other way around. So you're saying the same
thing. I'm saying they're both great songs.
Well, I'm saying one's better.
Well, I'm saying you're wrong once again.
You just wanted him to say he's wrong.
I know.
Once again, Miller, you have convinced me that you're wrong.
Okay.
Because I thought that you had much better taste than that.
Oh, I do.
I thought that you'd say, I thought, Bradley, that he'd argue that Pusher Man, considering his level of funkiness, and his, you know, Walter's secret name, by the way, is Dr. Funkenstein.
Yeah.
That he would actually proclaim Pusher Man as the song.
Oh, it's a good song. It's a great song.
But the pusher. That just means he dropped too much.
That was one of the great movie soundtracks that moved a genre forward.
So
that Superfly.
There's a great extended version of The Pusher on a live Steppenwolf.
17 minutes long.
Winter Park or someplace. I don't know.
17 minutes long.
That is
Winterland and Wonderland.
Wonderland. That's what it was.
No, not Wonderland. Winterland, which is
Winter. All right, that's what I said.
Winterland.
First.
No, you said Wonderland. It's Winterland.
So it's which the Winter is, Wonderland.
Which is Bill Graham's Winterland.
Right,
San
exactly.
Francisco.
Right. No, and
where's it at?
San Francisco. It was the place before Fillmore West became Fillmore West was Winterland.
Yeah. So I bought that for 13 or for a penny.
Oh, there you go.
I want a double.
So now we found out the real reason why Walter prefers that one versus the other one is that one he paid a penny for. With the,
I thought I'd pay $2 for it.
He probably paid $4.99 or $5.99.
Oh, no. So how many albums did you end up buying from them?
No, from Columbia?
Because wasn't it you got so many for a penny, then you had to buy
13 for a penny, and then you were supposed
eight
to
more
buy
or something
for the year.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, or not for the year, just 8 more period. So you could stretch it out for as long as you wanted to, which is why.
Oh, I always told my parents I had to buy eight right away because that's the obligation. They said, you signed up for what? I said, I just need $20, please.
Yeah, that's all
I said. I need a check now.
I had my own money. I probably got 50, 60, 70, I don't know, 70 albums from Club. Yeah, something like that. You know, 100 albums. I don't know. Just because every year I just do it again because I could find 13 albums I liked.
I could immediately. My problem was I couldn't limit
them
because I wanted so many of them.
Right.
It was, you know, it was me and crack cocaine. There was no way to say goodbye. Oh my God.
See, he likes to push it better.
There's the new Mamas and Papas. I need to have that now. Oh my God, Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. I have to have it now.
So I just watched, speaking of Pet Boys, I just watched the, it was the Brian Wilson, you know.
Smile?
Smile, what's it called?
Smile.
It's a recreation.
Right.
I was pretty impressed, actually.
Brian Wilson is, you know, and I think now he is finally recognized for the genius that he really was, you know. And, you know, you read interviews by John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
Oh, they watched him very carefully.
How they watched him and he watched them. Yep. And how they felt they were chasing each other into this genius race to create the next level of sound and concept, whether it was the dog sounds, the dog barking on Pet Sounds, or it was. So the interview I just read was Brian Wilson talking about Sgt. Pepper's was probably the most genius album he ever heard, because it incorporated all these brilliant different styles that he would never have done.
Right. Well, this is...
That's where the producer comes in.
Well, that's absolutely...
We were talking today about when the levee breaks, and Walden gave me kind of the lowdown on the harmonica of how that gets put in there, and it's...
So the deal with the levee breaks, it's an odd shift here, but the this is a totally produced, hard to ever play in concert. So they didn't play it in concert for 5 years.
So but, like Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young, how they couldn't perform
without Young,
so they had to go form a band.
Yeah. So
Stephen Stills did the whole thing.
So what they did with the harmonica part is they played it backwards. After they recorded it, they played it backwards, added echo to the backwards track, then flipped it around. So and they call that reverse echo. But basically, it gives us this very odd sort of murky sound. And then they lowered the pitch on it by, a little bit. And then they tweaked the bending of the notes. So they got everything they wanted and more. But
Robert, how do you do it live?
But Plant can't play harmonica like that.
Yeah. Well, can anybody play harmonica like that?
Well, what's worse was Page put in like four tracks of guitars on top of each other to get a really thick sound, and he did the same thing. He lowered the pitch. He did this. He did all this stuff to get it to and added echo to get the sound that is. And then Bonham, what they did with him is they recorded his this is in Headley Grange is where they were recording this, which is
this is Glyn Johns was the recording engineer at the time.
No, I think everything was done by Page owned this whole
He was the recording engineer. Page wasn't the recording engineer.
He
may have conceived it, but he probably was the recording engineer.
So they put Bottom in this hall in the basement, and then they strung microphones up on the first floor, second floor, up.
Well, that's an old Les Paul trick. Thank you very much. Yeah. But been there, done that. Thank you.
And then they sent it through an echo.
Yeah.
And to get that incredible sound on this that Bottom cannot play like that in concert ever. So now you have a harmonica you can't play, you got drums you can't play, and you can't ever recreate that guitar sound because, of course, it's like it's so overwhelming. Like I don't care how overdrive, it's so overproduced, but it sounds not overproduced. It just sounds amazing. You think like, wow, these guys are great.
Sounds thick.
It's a very thick song, but it's impossible to play in concert. So they didn't play it when they released what that was 71. Is that 71, 72 when Led Zeppelin 4 came out? The first time they played it in concert was 75 or 6. And they played it once.
They played it once in concert.
Yeah, there's one recording of it.
So
in Minneapolis.
You make me think of the first and second time, it's the first set of times I saw Tommy, and then the second set of times I saw Tommy. First set of times I saw Tommy, it was the Who by themselves. And they were in Fillmore East, and they did three nights worth, two concerts tonight, and they went to all six shows. But the second time was in the Metropolitan Opera House in New York. And they had a full orchestra.
A little different acoustics, too.
A lot of different acoustics, and they had guest singers and everything else. And so you have, in the first time, this stripped-down version of obviously a phenomenal, album. But then the second time, this attempt, and it was a great attempt, but it didn't, I don't think, pulled it off of what Tommy, what was as an opera.
Full orchestration.
So I just saw Tommy, I saw The Who last year, and with a full orchestra here in Denver. And they explained a little bit of how this works, because they're touring and each site had an orchestra.
Right.
But they're an orchestra from, so we had the Denver whatever symphony with, you know, right. And when they go to San Francisco, they get San Francisco Symphony. They send the sheet music out to these guys 2 days ahead of time. They practice the day of, and then they play at night. And I was totally blown away because it, you know, the overture was the overture. I mean, it was like perfect. And, but it was, you know.
So I will say this, that was 2022.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I'm talking about was 1970.
Oh, exactly. No,
and in 1970, you know, they're coming, you know, so they give that music. I want to say it's not the New York Philharmonic. It's like the Metropolitan Symphony Orchestra, yeah, or something like that is what they were called at the time. And I remember the Times article, I think it was, who talked about how they practiced with them because the orchestra leader said, no, we're going to practice this. So they did it for 30 days, and they did, and they did.
Yep.
They did 2 weeks.
Two weeks of shows.
Yeah, and I was there for the 2 weeks. It was something. It was a sight to behold, because again, you have Tina Turner was in it. You had some real star-weight celebrity people there. And it was great, but it wasn't equal to what they laid down on record. I'm sorry. Right.
So
my point is, however, 20 years later,
the better,
or 50 years later.
Yeah, 50 years later,
where the music is known, the people have listened to it, they've had opportunities to listen to it being performed, they probably played it a couple of times, and so now they're going, oh yeah. Da, 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 da. You know?
Right. So it's interesting, they don't tour. The orchestras don't tour. Now, in your case, they don't tour either, but they just played for a month.
Right.
There's been a few touring orchestras. I know Emerson, Lake, Palmer went broke bringing out a 50-piece orchestra with them. I saw one on one of their last shows, and it was in Des Moines. And
it's too much money.
It was just too much money.
So I don't know if you remember, and I think it was the Rolling Stones, and I want to say maybe the early 2000s, they were doing a tour, and they would and they'd go to different cities, and they'd get a choir locally to rehearse for 2 days. And they'd come out and do You Can't Always Get What You Want, mm-hmm, and a couple of other things like that. And I caught like 3 or 4 shows like that in New York and a couple of other places. And it was amazing, but again, it was amazing because of what you just described. Here it is, 30 years later, and this choir and the boys and women, men, girls in the choir, and they were all different ages, all had grown up listening to this music before, were able to hear it and then get ready for it, and so they knew what to expect. And so when when the choirs go and Mick is doing that whole thing, I mean, they were so in tune with that performance that you go, oh, wow. Crap. Yeah, and that felt like the album.
Right.
That felt like the album experience. But you're right. It's those definitely eye-opener sort of moments. But we go back to the producer. Where did that come from? Did it come from? And again, I'm not sure I know where it came from, you know, whether it was Pete's vision, whether it was Daughtry's vision, whether it was the producer's vision.
It was Pete's
probably
vision.
Probably Pete.
And, but so many, so this is, you know, like Jimmy Page versus the sound engineer. You got like Freddie Mercury with Bohemian Rhapsody versus whoever eventually produces the finals. You know, there's so many, there's these.
Layers.
I'll say there's a, or Brian Wilson on the board. It's like, you know.
Okay, but so stop. So Brian Wilson had the vision, had the, you know, and he's got that little bit of a weird mental thing going on in his brain where he could actually hear all those pieces. Yeah. He could hear the harmony that his brothers and the other in the band could do that they couldn't hear themselves.
And he wrote to that.
Right. And that's what I mean. And right. And so they couldn't hear what he heard.
But so he's a genius, not a problem. But I think I'm going to throw, Pete Townsend writes Tommy. He heard all that.
Right.
He created that.
Freddie Mercury wrote Prince.
Yep, Prince.
When he'd write stuff, he heard because he understood what the different instruments were going to do and be in that piece.
Well, so I'll say Stephen Stills with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He wrote the whole album, played all
these
Stevie
Wonder. Stevie
Wonder,
But there's
Stevie
a bunch Wonder. Of people like that that fit into this category where they're not the producers.
Right,
but they are the creative genius, and they produce something in the studio, and I'm sure the people on the board are like, oh boy, just like this is.
Oh, absolutely.
They're loving it because it's there. All they have to do is tweak it a little bit.
But
make sure,
but what I will say, to correct you, but to counterpoint you, is that the difference between the genius who hears that and the recording engineer who knows how to.
This is
where I was going before with the Glenn Johns commentary that there are guys that can walk into a studio and listen to him describe how he wants to muddy up that harmonica and say, okay, we're going to try three things here. I'm going to try doing this, and then I'm going to try flipping the tape around, and we're going to re-record that and see what happens.
Well, certainly, I'll just say in that one case, Jimmy Page claims he invented this technique, and
he did not invent that technique because I was there when someone did it in the '60s. So sorry.
Well, he probably didn't get a recording engineer telling him to do it. He probably did it himself. Which is what I mean. There's
okay. You know, well, maybe he did it himself, but he didn't invent it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Well,
he's got a big ego, so you know.
Okay. Well, whatever.
Well, and there's a lot of those engineers that will, like you say, they Lenny, tell me what you want to record, and you record it, and we're going to give you three choices, and then the third choice, that's the one. That's the one I want. That's exactly how it. And then you expand out from.
Or the artist says, you know, that's not really. How I'm hearing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I need it to be brighter, bolder. I need those drums to be more up front. That cymbal is not popping. Mm-hmm. You know, that bass line is just too
much. That's
muddy.
Standard studio banter right there.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. And it's that, but that's, I hate to say it, but that's the pedestrian level of the conversation.
Well, that's not necessarily creative. That's the creative process.
Right, that's
process.
Just, that's the process.
That's the creative
it's
process.
It's when you get to that and the guy says, I got you, but let's do this.
Let's do this one more time and do it this way.
And it takes it to the next level.
I want you to go into the men's room. Seriously,
toilet and sing five bars.
I want you to go in the men's room with the microphone. And we got a long enough extension for a headphone. And I want you to listen to yourself as I play back this track.
So wasn't that the...
that was Phil Spector's thing.
No, I want to say it was the Miles Davis biography where he locked himself in the bathroom to record... No, it wasn't Miles Davis. Who was it?
Miles Davis locked himself in his room.
No, there was one that I remember... it'll come to me, but... Locked himself in the bathroom, and his roommates or housemates are like, you know.
Yeah, but it was Miles Davis. And Miles Davis, actually it was John Coltrane. The book is called Chasing the Train, and it documents that when Miles and Coltrane were in the band together in the original Genius Quartet, there were two Genius Quartets. This was the first one, and Coltrane. Is recording with Miles, and they record the first of the Blue Note sessions, Kind of Blue. Mm-hmm. And Coltrane goes, so Miles says, okay, we're going to come back in a couple of weeks. I want you to think about this. And Coltrane goes home, locks himself in the room, and starts playing the same three notes. And he's with Alice Coltrane. He's, you know, I don't think she either was his wife or was winds up being his wife. And after like 3 or 4 days, Alice calls Miles Davis up and says, "I'm going to fucking kill him. I'm going to kill him." And he says, "What's the matter?" He says, "He's locked in his room, and for 3 days he's been playing the same 3 notes." So Miles takes the subway out to Queens, where they lived, out in Astoria, and in the house, and she lets him in the house, and Miles opens the door, and he knocks at the door, and he's playing the note. He said, "John, this is Mike. John, this is Miles. Open the door." Nothing. Playing the notes. After an hour of that, he says, "Mother, get away from the door. He says, "No." So they go on like this for 3 hours.
Back and forth, banging on the door, no, banging on the door, no.
He says, "Okay, what the hell are you doing? I'm calling the doctor." He says, "Dude, you don't understand." He says, "What's the matter?" He says, "I'm trying to find the meaning of these 3 notes." So he, everybody talks about Ascension that John Coltrane did later on after he recorded with Miles, about how it's his, a celebration of God and ascending. And this was John's first attempt at discovery of what a sound really, really means and what the message is. And when you hear Kind of Blue, there are moments in his solos where he's so bending a note, mm-hmm. and so playing that you go, "Oh my God!" And you get for a moment, and I mean, you'd have to really. And I've listened to that. I've worn out that album, 120 times. I've owned over 120 Kind of Blue. I've worn out 50 Kind of Blue CDs. Because I can listen to that album and hear nuances in Coltrane each time that's new and different because of what he was exploring, because of what Miles said to him, which was, "I want you to be able to really show somebody what you're saying."
Well, it's also what you're hearing, too.
No, it wasn't what...
And I mean, you're hearing it differently each time.
I don't know. How do you reach that level of genius? I don't know. But he obviously had some connection to some higher presence that allowed him to feel that. Mm-hmm. How do you get there? I don't know.
I don't know.
Anyway, so back to.
Well, all I was trying to say.
I'm sorry. Meanwhile, I got
back at the ranch.
Sorry, I got so serious.
You got these, Brian Wilson, and we talk about Towns. Al Cooper's another, creative genius in that same fashion.
John Hammond.
You have these people who can conceptualize in their head the whole thing, and somehow get people to
do
it.
John Hammond with Dylan.
So there was a marvelous interview with John Lennon talking about David Bowie, because John Lennon's style was not that. He was applauding, mechanical. I mean, great. Don't get me wrong, but
he worked
hard in the studio with the Beatles to try and get it together to get the Beatles sound thing. So he's invited to the Philly sessions with David Bowie to do Young American, and David Bowie comes in with little slips of paper and he pulls out of his pocket, and he's got a choir over here. He's got this, "I want you to sound like this, and I want you to do this over here." And it's just, and John Lennon is watching this as the most foreign, alien type of production, and then of course Young American comes out of it. He's like, "How does this happen?" It became fast friends, but it was one of those things where you know, it's this, it's what's in your head, and I'll put David Bowie in the same boat of someone who conceptualizes the entirety of the music and then somehow communicates it to the other musicians he has to play with, which is, you know, kind of interesting.
Not at that level, but David Byrne sometimes, not all the time, can do some of that.
See, I don't,
but not a lot. But
I'm not certain. So what's interesting about David Byrne is he had the heads with him. And he, I think, personally, I think he believed he was better than all of them.
Oh, yes. No, not he absolutely, in his mind, knew he was better than anybody. Right.
But I don't think, I mean, I think he was blessed with having a band that was that good.
But what I guess what I'm saying is that he heard that and made and understood how to make it better. I'm not saying that it was he who created that, but he could hear that and say, I just know how to tweak this and tweak that. It was almost like the engineer in him, so to speak.
I like David Byrne tremendously, but I'm not willing to put him over there.
I said it's not on the same level. But it just, you made me think of David Byrne for a second there and how there were moments and still flashes of moments, the new stage thing that he's done, which has the
Utopia.
It has the interesting things. Yeah. I mean, there are some interesting things that he's doing today that others aren't doing.
Well, I think he's a visual artist much more than a.
True.
And I think that it makes separates him, and it certainly from Remain in Light on, gave him sort of the backdrop to explore that music and visual sort of landscape he creates.
So what role, because it's interesting, you just made me flash on something, because Leonardo da Vinci was both a musician and an artist and a sculptor and everything else, and there are others like that. So what part of genius influence and stems from what inside one another. Does a person who's a visual artist, can they also become a great musician because they have that internal genius?
I don't think they're related. I think there are people that are both creative and visually creative, and you find that at basically all levels, all the way up to genius. And some geniuses, it's like...
and some of them are just flat out on the spectrum.
Yeah. So you know, Charlie Chaplin was a great pianist. So was Albert Einstein. And, you know, you get these like...
Oh, that's how you see, but you go where I was... And again, I don't know how to draw the line there, except to say that there are certain people who are able to have those things inside themselves that somehow magically come out, as you mentioned. I've got about Charlie Chaplin, but Charlie Chaplin as a great actor, as a great producer, as a great visionary, as a great pianist.
Right. So, but I just think that creativity just comes in so many varieties. And this is just me talking here. There's no research that I can point to or anything like that, but...
Bradley, get on that right now, please.
Creativity, yeah, edit all that. I'm speaking from experience. No, I think creativity runs so many ways, as you know, and because of that, some people go wherever it takes them, and if it's all visual, it's all visual. But if it's all visual and it's all musical, or it's all acting, or it's all something else, there's so many actors that are good singers and also good, guitarists or whatever else. And you see that. And some of them are good songwriters, which is kind of...
But you also step out into people like Steve Jobs, Bill Gates.
He's just idiots.
I mean, they took that creative energy and just channeled it in one direction.
But I will say is Bill Gates or Steve Jobs creative or a great marketer?
That's creativity. You look at Larry Ellison, from Oracle.
Okay, I mean, well, is Larry Ellison just an arrogant asshole, or
But it's kind of in that same genre. It's like you have that creative energy that's 360 degrees. Do you do it with music? Do you do it with business?
See, I don't put Bill Gates into a genius category.
I think
Bill Gates was a brilliant businessman who saw something and said,
he saw the music.
That and that is going to be something, and I need to go influence that.
I'm not going to bore you with my old stories of
these guys. Oh, yeah, I know the Dos, the Dos days. But again, it's not that Jobs wasn't a brilliant guy also, but Jobs without
Wozniak
is nothing. Gates without, who was the guy who Gates worked with, because nobody remembers him.
But still, my point is, they had that creative vision. They knew where it was going to go. They knew how to
do it. I'm not sure.
That they knew where
it was going to go. And I'm sure some of it evolved along the way, too.
That's something, and I need to go explore that. I don't think that they saw where it was going to go.
But they knew it was going somewhere.
They hoped it was going
somewhere. This is the thing, is that in those days, and I remember them quite well, there was no computer industry.
Right.
And so there was no vision of a computer industry, and there was no vision of the internet. There was no vision of phones.
Mainframes. You
know, yeah. And so even talking about building anything on a 6400 chip or a 6100 chip or a 6000 chip, you know, it's like,
But, you know, you're going back to bringing it back into music, you look at somebody like Brian Wilson, who had this vision, I want to do this. And he knew where he wanted to take it, but when it went out to the masses, where did it go?
It was very successful.
Exactly. So he had that kind of connection.
But he could pull that thread through, and he could do it. I think Gates, without the people around him,
Steve Jobs, without Woz, that's all part of that creative energy. You put those people around you, and a musician has his band. You were talking about David Byrne.
Yeah.
Steven still has Steven Stills.
But Byrne had
that. He's just a singer in a one-man band.
But he knew how to shape that band.
We're gonna argue this point with you.
So we're going to change the subject now. So you wanted to talk about...
So this year in particular...
Oh, this is good. We're 45 minutes into it. Now you want
this
to get
year,
around,
this year in particular...
Here's the topic of the day.
Is this a new format? We work backwards from there?
Well, we have one half of a show. Now we have another half.
I will say, we haven't been together for quite a while, so we've definitely covered the miscellaneous ramblings. So.
Well, this is, you know, ramble on! I was talking to Walden earlier on, and I'm reflecting upon that 2023 is really, for what I've seen, as the year of the concert.
The year of the cat?
Because you have Beyonce, who's broken all records, Taylor Swift, who's broken all records, major artists who have gone back to touring and touring big and having big sellout. It's also the year of the big concert cost of ticket, where tickets are just gigantic in cost. And people willing to pay $4,000 for a night with Taylor Swift. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I like Taylor Swift. Don't get me wrong, I like Beyonce. And don't get me wrong at some point or another, I probably would have paid $400 for a ticket. $4,000 for a ticket is a pretty big stub. I don't care how much
for your 2.5 hours.
I don't care how much your child is begging you, or stuff like that.
Sure.
$4,000 is a lot of money for a ticket, and I'm just trying to in my mind imagine where it goes next. I mean, recently I went to see my daughter, my grandson, and I went to see Billy Joel and Stevie Nicks. Phenomenal concert. I mean, one of the better concerts I've seen in quite some time. 60,000 people in Arrowhead Stadium. The sound was perfection, which I was amazed at, considering how, you know, it's a stadium.
It's a stadium, yeah.
And it's a shell and everything, but the sound was perfection. And it was 60,000 people Walden's age, which is pretty old. You know, all singing every single song. So it wasn't like, and it was all hits.
Right. Oh yeah.
It was all.
They leave the B-sides at home.
Everything. So it was. I mean, Stevie Nicks probably did 3 hours. Billy Joel did 2.5 hours. They did a half hour to 45 minutes together, and it was. And the things they did together was Tom Petty, which was cool unto itself. That they did a bunch of did 45 minutes of Tom Petty. Was very,
dragging
very cool.
my ass
oh
around.
Oh my God, it was so good. That probably the Tom Petty stuff was probably the, you know, everything was great, but that was just over the top.
Well, we
really
saw
good.
Fleetwood Mac here at the Pepsi Center. They had their guitarist from Petty,
and it was just so good.
And they played a couple.
But
of
but
songs.
Again, okay, we paid my daughter. Not we. My daughter treated on the concert. I think she and we have great seats. $350?
Right.
Not $3,050.
So I want to take this and put a reality check on ticket prices. Because, yes, that is way... I mean, $300 is an expensive ticket.
But and worth everybody, by yeah, the way.
But $4,000, I'd rather just go, buy a car. Like cheap,
well,
you know,
you can't thing, buy a car. Yeah. Walden, I know how old you are. Cars don't go for $4,000.
Walden wants to buy a new Saturn.
Exactly, for $4,000. So here's the thing, though. So in our youth, you could see great bands for under $10. And recently someone wrote on one of my, you know, little Quora things, did Led Zeppelin ever tour in the late 60s?
Yes.
And early 70s? And if so, why were their concert tickets so expensive? And I'm like,
what? <That's> okay, so we told the story before about the Who premiering Tommy. And I yeah, saw him all right. 6 nights. Do you know what the top ticket cost?
$675.
No, sir.
It was probably like, what, $25-$30?
No.
$499.
Right.
No way.
Was the top ticket price cost. It was $499 for the front seats, $399 for the back, and then $299 for upstairs. At the Fillmore East.
Adjusted for inflation, it's what?
I don't know. Go do it. At 1970 to now.
So
Bradley, while we think about this.
Here I'm going to give you some interesting just little tidbits. So the first American tour of Led Zeppelin.
I saw them.
$2.50.
I saw them.
That was, you know.
I paid $3.
He got robbed.
The following year, Madison Square Garden, The Who and Led Zeppelin.
I was
there. $5.75.
I was there. Next. You know,
and then well, we're going to skip forward a few years.
Skip a few Lemmy concerts.
No, 1977, their biggest tour ever.
Led Zeppelin.
Right. This is, Richfield, Ohio Coliseum, but it was, where somewhere around here? Oh, yeah. $9.50.
Because I think I saw him in Soldier Field for $9.
Now, that's under $10. Now, if you do the math, the $10 ticket would be $50 today. So right. Between 77 and now is basically five times. So, and 1977, the minimum wage was like probably $3.50, $3.70, maybe $4. So it's like 2.5 times the minimum wage. Minimum wage now, even if you're at great minimum wages at $15 to $20, that would be a $50 ticket. Oh, same thing. But we're not paying $50 for tickets.
Right. We're paying $150, $200, $300 a ticket. And that's just for this. You talk about, like I said, Taylor Swift, $4,000. Beyonce?
That's a lot of chips.
I'm telling you, that's no... Now, we got to remember, these concerts are sold out in 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
These concerts...
Well...
We have people on the aftermarket. The parents are paying $9,000, $10,000.
So I was at lunch with someone when Taylor Swift came here, and she was talking about, my daughter wants to go to Taylor Swift. I said, so... It's been sold out forever. Yeah, I can get a ticket for $10,000. I'm just right. Like, $10,000, think about that as one you know, a half a semester of your kid's college education. You're blowing one night.
Right. It's insane.
But it's Taylor Swift. You understand.
But you're also looking at this, too.
Okay. But so, again, I go back. If someone would have, so let's go back to this, you know, to what, you know, you're talking about, you know, seeing the Who or seeing Led Zeppelin, the Who.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And, you know, I was probably, you know, when my part-time job was making $5 an hour, maybe. $4 an hour, maybe.
In the 70s, yeah.
No, I'm talking about in the late 60s.
Then you were making good money.
I was making good money because I had a good job.
Yeah.
You know, but still, so that was cost to me. And I'd go see him. When I saw Hendrix with Band of Gypsies, he played three straight nights. Top ticket was, and one of them was New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve was $8. All the other tickets were like $6. And I had front row or so seats. But I was spending a lot of my salary. But this was, oh, but it's Hendrix. You don't understand.
Now you're paying,
it's Hendrix.
Now you're paying 1 hour of labor salary. But this is the thing, is that you have to equate it to what you earn. And as you point out, you're making $4 or $5 an hour. You're spending $6. That's an hour and a half of your labor, right? Today, you can't, an hour and a half of my labor, well, maybe my labor, but of an average.
Right, a person making $60,000 a year.
Or $30,000 a year, right? I mean, there's, you know, minimum wage earners can't go to concerts.
No.
And that cuts out, you know, a quarter of the population immediately.
Well, in my opinion, too, it's no longer a concert. It's an event.
Well, that's your marketing thing. I mean,
when you were back, going to Led Zeppelin in the 70s, you had three racks full of red, blue, and green park cans. You know, now you have semi upon semi upon semi that's hauling stages and wardrobes and, you know, custom laser shows and sound systems. So that stuff isn't cheap. But
let's just say you could see Pink Floyd, who had all of that every time in the 70s for $7 to $10. I mean, this is actually a...
When I saw Get Your Ya-Ya's Out.
Did you get your Ya-Ya's out?
I'm trying to think. What was the early 70s tour? Was it Ya-Ya's?
That was 70, I don't know...
With Stevie Wonder?
I saw Stevie Wonder.
Sorry, there was seven nights, Madison Square Garden. Seven straight nights, Madison Square Garden. There were 30 of us that went together. We bought out this whole section and everything. We smuggled in 5 cases of champagne every night into the Madison Square Garden. Don't ask us how we did that.
12 packs full of Schlitz, you know.
You know, no Schlitz. We were drinking champagne. We were high class. And we were doing this. If we paid more than $10 a ticket,
right?
I'm overstating it. Yeah, and that was, as you said, Walden, it was, you know, full band, extras, supporting singers, the whole deal. It was the real schmear.
Yep.
I mean, this is the Rolling Stones when the Rolling Stones were the act to go see.
Right.
You know, not this now leftover 85-year-old Mick Jagger with the cane.
It's when you can have Stevie Wonder as your warm-up
act. Come on, Stevie Wonder's the opening act, and people are booing Stevie Wonder. Say, shut the hell up. What are you talking about?
Oh, my God. I saw that tour, and I remember because I was hitchhiking out of Indianapolis, and the tour had been sold out forever. And pre-internet, some guy had just, like, said it's all sold out, and then he discovered they didn't sell an entire section of whatever the Coliseum is in Indianapolis. And this guy's on the radio, and he's like, the radio comes out and says, we just have heard that there's 475 tickets or something. This guy in the car.
You know what it really was?
U-turns.
But you know what it really was? You know what it really was?
Ticketmaster.
Do you remember that? This was where they used to have the holdbacks.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so then at the last minute, the guy would on the radio station.
Sold
would
be, out. Wait a minute.
The radio station had been given 25 or 100 tickets, mm-hmm. and now some guys. I was just saying that they used to do that.
Yeah,
this is like for the records.
Right.
We were talking about the records. Then they'd go and sell them or give away oh, we just got a tranche of tickets for the Stones tonight. It's 25 tickets in the second row.
I'll take the fourth caller on line three.
Right. Now, this is actually the box office, and they were embarrassed, and it was a big deal because
they sold tickets at the box office.
Right. Well, that's the only place you can get them.
Tickets. Where do you think I bought my tickets for the Rolling Stones at Madison Square Garden? We were online.
Vinny on the Street?
We were online for 4 days.
You were in line.
In line for 4 days, with these 25, 30 people, we all took turns in the line, getting on the line and off the lines. And you'd have to, for you to be part of it, you'd have to be willing to be there when the box office was about to open. But to keep the place online, we set up when the first started. We were like the 10th group who was set up like that. We set up tents and everything. We had food. It was catered. We had food. We had other things. And, you know, you're in the streets, and the cop would come by and says, you guys okay? He says, you want something? I said, oh, okay. You guys are okay.
But that was part of your $10 ticket event.
Oh, yeah. My God.
That was part of the mystique. That was part of... You don't see people lining up outside anymore.
It was part of the... It's sort of like when, you know, when the... Was it the Broncos? When they were going to sell the playoff tickets before they would do it online, they'd have people lined up for days. Mm-hmm. Oh, the Broncos are going to make it. I'm going to go stand overnight and go wait for the ticket to go on sale.
So where I was going with this is Ticketmaster.
Oh, my God. Don't start on me with Ticketmaster.
Well, I know, but this is part of the you know, inflation, part of the inflation process of tickets. Is we have now these, you know, like Fandango for movies and this for that. You have all these ticket
middlemen
brokers that allow.
Let's go. The facility fee.
Yeah.
The service fee.
Yeah.
The concession fee.
It's like you're buying a house.
The handling fee. By the time you get done, you got 100. I think someone said, I bought a ticket to a concert. The concert itself was $75. But it was $120 in the handling fees.
Right. That's what I'm getting at, is that the broker has become the ticket. Mm. And because the band doesn't get a cut of the broker's fees. Right. They get the cut of the concert cost. And the concert cost. And so this is it's interesting because if you want to pay the band more, the concert price increases, and I think proportionately
the ticket fee,
the fees increase, and so you could you know increase the you know the
so who was it this year? Springsteen, right?
Springsteen
who said that, well, I'm worth it.
Yeah,
because his tickets were like $4,000.
Yeah, it was really when it first started getting exposed of that secondary market, just
and
the primary market even too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And so, and I've seen Bruce Forsey a number of times, but I'm not going to go spend $4,000. As good and Bruce is a phenomenal in concert, but $4,000 is not my idea. I might as well. I'm going to sit at home. Play in my living room.
I'm going to go buy the master tapes of everything.
I want to buy the ultra Blu-ray with Dolby Atmos.
Yeah.
You know, I want that. Okay. If I'm going to spend that money, you know what? I don't need to be in the stadium. I'm going to buy the recording of that, the high quality 4K process with Dolby Atmos. I could sit there. I bought one recently of something, and it was just phenomenal, the quality.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll never again do this where I have to go sit in a stadium. Mm-hmm. And I did this with Stevie Nicks, because my daughter wanted to go.
Never do it until next week.
Exactly.
but that was a different reason. That was because I wanted to. So that was the family experience of me going with my daughter and my grandson. And that was a reason to do that, because they asked me to go, and I wanted to go there and experience that with them. But at the same token, when my grandson came down to visit me at my home in Florida, we actually went and we went to buy one. We went to buy a Prince Ultra Blu-ray Dolby Atmos concert because I wanted him to see and experience when I was there at that concert. And he was like, holy crap, this is amazing. And you're like, you know, and you guys know I got a big 86-inch screen TV. I have a great sound system and stuff like that. And you can have that experience. You can't have that experience.
You have a different experience.
Yeah. You pause it. I'm going to go. Let's take a break. Grab a slice of pizza. I got to go to the bathroom. Kind of thing. Twins, could you stop for a second? I got to get up. I got to go to the bathroom. Hold it.
My glass is empty.
Yeah. Hold on a second. I got to go to the bathroom. You can't say, you can't do that, right?
Well, you can do it, just that he's not going to listen to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. He's like, or you get criticized if you're in the front row. What's this guy doing right here?
That was the other thing. And so I forget what I was watching or something like that. It was a comedy concert or something on like ruthless. Netflix, yeah. Or something like that. And the guy or gal got up and he said, hold it.
Where are you going?
Who told you? Get back in your goddamn seat. Mofo, I did not tell you that you can get up. I'm in the middle of a joke. And until I finished my joke, so he made him sit there. And every time he started to get up, he said, sit down. And it was hilarious because you know that he was playing to the crowd, obviously,
oh, yeah.
In terms of this. But it was like this interplay that, and that's what makes me think of it, is of how life, you know, reality,
right.
You know, and enjoyment or something like that, it's like, okay, I can't sit here for an hour and a half and not go to the bathroom. I'm sorry. I got to go.
Well, you're an old man.
Yes, I am. I am an old man. And on that note, I think I'd like to say this is great again.
Yeah.
I understand, Bradley, from rumor has it that there's number one.
Number one is on the website.
The first one is back. And on the website.
We'll
and
have to cut this part out because, you know, number one doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Number one is really number two.
Number eight, yeah. It feels like all the placeholders are there. They're all in there. I just got to start loading them up. And actually, I'll load this one up in the next
So can we days. Record a tease for the stuff coming up and say that we're proud to say that number one is now on the, you know, you could do a short little snippet and say a tease, and there's how many more in the can?
There's like 20.
20?
At least.
Would you believe that we have 20 of these?
I can't believe we don't have 25
or
30.
we may have more. I mean, some of them I chopped in half,
yep.
You know, just because they were like 3 hours long.
Or
we, actually, nobody wants to sit and listen to Lenny for 3 hours.
Well, I do. but I need my sleep.
There you go. That's true. That's true.
I was about to say, we need to drift off.
All right, let me wrap this one up here.
Thank you very much.